There is a halfway mark between the known and unknown. A middle ground or chamber where divine wisdom and truth reside. In this middle chamber, we will explore and expose the ruling paradigms of social engineering, mind control, government conspiracies, and cover-ups. Join us as we navigate the territories and boundaries of natural law and the ancient principles of the sacred feminine and divine masculine. Examine and consider alternative energy systems, holistic healing arts, and wild soulful living to train our awareness in a most novel and abstract manner to view reality from an entirely new perspective. Welcome to the Middle Chamber.
Welcome once again, everyone, to another episode of the Middle Chamber. It is I, your hyperdimensional host, for the duration of this talk. I am joined, as always, by my wife and co-conspirator in this endeavor, Mater X. Greetings, my love.
Greetings, everyone. I'm really looking forward to our discussion with Dr. Colin Ross.
Yes, we're so excited to welcome a real, you know, it seems a titan in the field of, not only in the field of multiple personality disorder and satanic ritual abuse studies and treatment, but also in currently he's been talking a lot about research involved with the CIA, mind control studies, MK Ultra, and his review of thousands of documents through the Freedom of Information Act, which we're going to talk to him about. And anyone who's listening who is not familiar, he's done some shows with Gnostic Media, over at GnosticMedia.com, as well as Dial M for Mason, our friend Jay Wright, and also I believe he was on the Vinnie Eastwood show. So we wanted to bring him into the Middle Chamber and hopefully bring a new perspective to the discussion. Before we welcome him in, though, we're going to just go ahead and say the few things we like to say before the shows kick off. For the latest in the Middle Chamber, you can always go and look on our Facebook page at Freighter X, first name, Mater X, second name. So that's the Freighter X, Mater X on Facebook, as well as the blog, freighterx.blogspot.com. And then Mater X's blog is?
My blog is materx369.blogspot.com. It's called Spilt Milk, and it's just a collection of my poetry and things of interest to me that I would like to share with the world.
Excellent. All right, great. So check out her blog as well. And the show's website is middlechamberfx.wordpress.com. That's middlechamber, the letters fx.wordpress.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at TMC369. And we're also, you know, as always, we're asking anyone that can help to support our big summer trip plans. We're not going to go into all the details right now. We talked about it last show. Check out the last episode and the ones before where we've talked about it. But if you can help out, please give to our PayPal account under Mater X's email at materx369@gmail.com. materx369@gmail.com. And we're also going to have our own little Indiegogo fundraiser very shortly to help the finance for that tour. So we'll keep you posted. And thanks for anyone that can give any help. We really appreciate it. Things are really tough around here, as I'm sure you can imagine. Okay, in just a moment, we are going to welcome our extra special guest for this episode's chat. And speaking of chats, this show's chat room can be found at middlechamberchat.chatango.com, or go to our website for the link and also the Facebook page. And we have seen an increase in the chat room attendance these past few weeks, so we're really excited. If it's Saturday night at 9 p.m. Central Standard Time, join us in the chat room where we will review the podcast together. It's sort of a unique opportunity. You can listen to the podcast with us on Saturday nights, Central Standard Time, 9 p.m., and we'll review the whole thing together and field any questions or comments from any of the listeners. We're just trying something out. It's a new kind of format. Things are always changing, so we're just switching stuff up and trying to get the right formula of listening and podcasting simultaneously. So anyways, come and check it out with us and see what you think. Now, special thanks to last week's guest, Andrea Vitimus, discussing his prolific work, Hands-On Chaos Magic, with us. Now check that out, podcast number 9 in the archives. Okay, one more thing to announce: our new media network, Conspiracy HQ, your one-stop shop for conspiracy theory headquarters, which will launch next month over at conspiracyhq.com. And of course, the Middle Chamber is proud to join the ranks of these cutting-edge, innovative media providers, everybody. It's going to be an amazing experience, and we've all gathered under one banner, which means that our format here in the Middle Chamber is going to go through some changes, important changes, as time goes by. Stay tuned for more details and information, and check back with our website and various media pages to keep informed and updated on all the amazing things which we will be bringing to you, coming straight at you from the digital underground to your media device. All the more ways to listen to the paradigm shift. So I just wanted to reflect for a moment on the past shows that we've had here, the past few shows. We had that bonus show we did with the Type 1 Radio Lounge a couple episodes back now. It's posted at Sync Book Radio Network, or at thesyncbook.com. And of course, we had episode 8, part 1 and 2, with Jan Ervin and Joe Atwill, talking about the psychedelic intelligence, the connections between the CIA and mind control and the counterculture, and just some amazing things. We've also, on our own, been reviewing a lot of the material of Dave McGowan's and other researchers who are exploring the possibility of the manufacture of our entire counterculture in America and worldwide as well. So it's that interview with Jan and Joe Atwill is steadily becoming the most often downloaded podcast in our archives right now, so it's obviously an issue that people are interested in. And I wanted to reflect on what all this research and review that we're doing into the so-called hidden or even occulted side of our reality, of our society. This material, it really shakes the foundations of the institutional mythology which calibrates many of our moral compasses. And the especially in America, the civic mythology we were imprinted through our entire education and indoctrination programming with shapes how we see our society, how we see the world, how we see human culture in general. And to learn that everything you know is not only wrong, but quite possibly deliberately contrived, designed to sculpt your awareness, is sort of a foundation-shaking prospect. The research that we have reviewed and discussed holds no punches. It hits us in the psyche, where it hurts, attacking the innocent idols, gods, and heroes of our youth. Even, you know, everything is laid open now. Even our false reality becomes desacralized. What remains sacred in our pop modern, you know, postmodern pop culture world, what remains sacred now? Everything, even our in emotional imprintings of memories of the past. I grew up in the 70s. You know, as a matter of fact, maybe I'm feeling a little expansive and morbid on my 44th birthday today, but I grew up in the 70s listening to vinyl records and those mythical 8-track tapes. I can still smell them to this day, you know, that smell, that, oh, I don't know what it is, ozone-type electronic component smell. I can remember hunkering down on the carpet in front of the family Zenith cabinet stereo with a stack of records and tapes and very few cassettes and absolutely no CDs, everybody, sorry, just records and tapes. And I would study the album images and read the liner notes and lyrics and become one with many dreams which manifested listening to all that different music. How many millions of other kids joined in that collective action, dreaming the collective dreams created like a egregore, a thought form, a magical thought form, right? Who knows? Maybe our guest today can shed some light on this, you know, and the deconstruction of collective myth and the socio-cultural impact. And we have so much to cover with Dr. Ross, and we hope to hear more about his research into declassified CIA documents through the Freedom of Information Act, which focus especially material relating to the Scottish Rite Foundation funding CIA mind control research. But first, we also wanted to explore more of other research that Dr. Ross is involved in, which we haven't really heard at all and discussed in the various interviews that I listed that at the beginning of this. So let's first introduce our guest for today's podcast. This is Dr. Colin Ross, and Dr. Ross is a psychiatrist who received his MD from University of Alberta, Canada in 1981. He completed his specialty training in psychiatry at the University of Manitoba in 1985. He's the author of over 170 papers in professional journals. titles, most of them dealing with disassociation, psychological trauma, and multiple personality disorder. He is a past resident of International Society for the Study of Disassociation and Trauma and a former Laughlin Fellow of the American College of Psychiatrists. So Dr. Ross, he comes from authority with what he's speaking about. He's spent a lot of time, obviously, and energy involved in looking at all this, and he's founded the Ross Institution for Psychological Trauma in 1985, and that's a private organization specializing in treating mental health issues. He's also written 27 books, including The CIA Doctors, Human Rights Violations by American Psychiatrists, Military Mind Control, A Story of Trauma and Recovery, The Great Psychiatry Scam, and Trauma Model Therapy, A Treatment Approach of Trauma, Disassociation, and Complex Comorbidity. So with all that said, welcome, Dr. Ross, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me, and happy birthday.
Thank you so much. Now, I just wanted to give Materx a chance to, if you wanted to also welcome Dr. Ross and share anything you had to say, because you've done some reviewing of the material we're looking at today.
I'm really looking forward to talking about the things that you mentioned also, and my attention when I was looking into your website, Dr. Ross, my attention was drawn to a paper you wrote entitled Traditional Beliefs in Electromagnetic Fields. And if we have time, I'd like to talk a little bit about that stuff too.
Sure. That's one of my favorite topics.
Good. Because it resonates with me too. So excellent. Welcome to the Middle Chamber.
Yes. And that I'm also excited about. I was really intrigued, and made me look forward even more to discussing these things with you when I took a look at all the material out there to see there was so much more to discuss. You had barely scratched the surface, I think, in what you have to offer folks listening. So I'm really excited. And obviously, we wanted to discuss your MK Ultra mind control research and the CIA, especially in connection with your field of psychiatry, and more specifically, the areas of research noting the involvement of outside organizations such as the Scottish Rite Foundation. Funding of mind control studies for the CIA and other government agencies. Now, there are many topics that we want to discuss with you about this, but just in general, jumping right into that one, because I know the listeners are excited to hear more, and I've gotten feedback from people who are really looking forward to this conversation. So, I mean, can you just, we know that you were, through the Freedom of Information Act, you were able to gain access to some 15,000 pages of declassified documents, correct?
Right, and they were all declassified in the 70s, basically.
So they were basically, they've been available all this time for anyone who sought the same channels to gain access to them. Is that correct?
Right, and nobody previously has gone through them quite as thoroughly based on expertise in dissociative disorders.
Well, that's an excellent point to make, of course. And so launching from that perspective, can you just kind of go ahead and what did you learn from these declassified documents, and especially in relation to what you just described, the dissociative disorders?
Well, so I finished my psychiatry training in 1985, and in 4 years of training, I had no exam questions, no seminars, no lectures, no assigned readings, nothing on childhood sexual abuse or its consequences. And the textbook that I used to prepare for my exams and so on was the Comprehensive Textbook of Psychiatry, published in 1980, and which is almost 3,500 pages long. In there's half a paragraph talking about how common incest is, with a reference to a 1955 study saying that it's one family out of a million, and it's actually more than one family out of 100. So that was the kind of starting point from my experience in psychiatry. Incest is incredibly rare. Childhood sexual abuse, we don't even need to talk about it. We don't talk about rape. We don't talk about sexual harassment in the workplace. We don't talk about family violence. All that stuff was just off the radar. And then starting up late 70s and then really gaining steam in the 80s, a whole bunch of studies came out proving what everybody knows today, which is childhood sexual abuse is a big problem and very common, along with physical abuse, family violence. So the starting point was, here's some stuff that doesn't exist, that we don't talk about, and lo and behold, over a decade plus, it gets demonstrated to be very common, people see it all the time, it's part of mainstream culture.
Not just that, if you don't mind me interrupting, it seems to be very prevalent in the social circles that are kind of quote unquote in control of things.
Yeah, it's not just some like down and out scuzzy people in the backwoods. It's all levels of society. And so then the next phase was, I started to hear at conferences in the late 80s, but I didn't actually start hearing from patients till I moved to Dallas in 91, stories about satanic ritual abuse and growing up in satanic cults. So I started writing a book about that in 92, 3, and it ended up getting published in 1995. It's called Satanic Ritual Abuse, Principles of Treatment. And basically, there wasn't that much to read about it. So I read the existing books. There wasn't really any, professional literature on it at all. And the more I looked into it in individual cases and just in the literature as a whole, it was just like lost in the fog, lost in the shadows. You could never really grab hold on to actual documented facts and reality, which was very frustrating because I assumed that not all of it was real, but I also assumed that more than zero of it was real. So the sort of the next wave was hearing about all this stuff that nobody talks about. There's no professional literature on it, certainly no exam questions on it. And then it's can't really prove it or disprove it. Then the third wave was also when I arrived in the United States, starting to hear from people with multiple personalities. Well, when I was a kid, I was taken to this sort of secret lab or taken to a military base, and all this experimental stuff was done to me to create alter personalities that the handlers had control of. So now I'm going, oh, well, great. So which pattern is this going to follow? Is it going to be like incest, where we end up with tons of proof? Or is it going to be like satanic ritual abuse, where it's sort of murky in the shadows, can't ever prove it? And lo and behold, the more I looked into the CIA military mind control, the bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger the mountain of documents became. So that's my personal experience with that.
So what you're describing is this deliberate narrowing of the scope in the field of psychiatry with what they were willing to acknowledge was happening in the households and in the families.
Right, exactly.
And so how was your book initially received, this SRA book, when you first released it?
Basically, it was silenced by organ psychiatry. Like, I wasn't reviewed in psychiatry journals. Nobody wrote about it. Nobody said they liked it or hated it or anything. It was just basically silence. It sold somewhere in the ballpark of 5,000 or 6,000 copies, which for a University of Toronto Press academic book is pretty good. So really, it just kind of got ignored by mainstream psychiatry.
That's remarkable. I found, of course, I come from more the layman perspective, but I did join several fraternal orders and get involved in research organizations within there, and worked on researching and presenting papers that was of a controversial nature with regards to mainstream thinking inside the fraternal orders. And again, most of my research and stuff was greeted with silence, with indifference, right, and with basically no one had any, didn't even want to respond. They didn't, right. And it's remarkable that when you're focused on things that are sort of like cage rattling topics, this is where we're shaking the box up here and saying, hey, wait a second, there's stuff going on outside of this narrow minded thinking, and people are just frozen within almost indifference to how to respond.
Right. So on the CIA military mind control side, in the late 80s, early 90s, therapists started hearing all these satanic ritual abuse stories. And then I think it was a bad move that a lot of people started suing their alleged perpetrators when they didn't have any, court-level documented proof, which is very hard to get. And then a big backlash started in 92 when the False Memory Syndrome Foundation was formed. And they mounted a systematic attack against people who diagnose multiple personality, people who treat childhood sexual abuse and so on, trying to completely discredit it. And people on the board of that organization, I was later able to document, were top secret cleared CIA mind control contractors. And so that was another part of the story I started to see. But basically, I got attacked, trashed personally, ridiculed in a variety of different places in the 90s, because they heard that I was working on this book. And one of them got hold of a book proposal that my agent sent to some New York publishers, which is a whole other crazy story. So all these 10 plus New York publishers, mainstream publishers, all rejected the book. And one of them said the reason he was rejecting the book was nobody would want to read this except the 10 million people who watch The X-Files every week. Which didn't seem like the soundest business decision ever. But so I ended up publishing it myself through my own publishing company. And once the book came out, because the book is 100.0% based on documents, total silence. Nobody's ridiculed it in public ever since.
That's remarkable indeed. The timing on these, the timing on the development of your research too, I find remarkable because it coincides with what, like you said, the social trends that were going on. First, there was one little inkling towards what's happening, and then suddenly there's all this field clinical data that's coming in with people reporting these experiences in these decades, progressively moving towards what's now people are openly accepting. Even though, of course, there are those with the false memory camp busily fighting the battle, but right. there's plenty of people now who are in mainstream who are accepting that this is a definite phenomenon. And I personally have made contact with several people, such as Jay Parker and also Kathy O'Brien and Mark Phillips, who obviously are known in this field and have clearly documented evidence, and along with people like yourself and the research that you're reviewing and putting out there. And this is one of the reasons why we wanted to come on. But specifically talking about the funding of these programs, you with the research that you were able to do, looking at the material that you were able to review, you found evidence that basically lists the foundations and organizations that fund. Can you talk a little bit about the CIA, the need for funding, first of all, and sure. what goes into that, how an organization would get involved in funding mind control research, for example?
Well, first of all, you can't get anything done without money in the world, right? So the CIA was formed in 1947, and there's already well-documented mind control programs operational in the U.S. Army in the Second World War. And then the OSS, which was the Office of Strategic Services, which was the precursor of the CIA, was kind of disbanded at the end of the war. And then it was all like reorganized and officially became the CIA in 1947. And the first CIA mind control program that's documented was April 20-something, I forget the exact date, 1950. It was signed into existence by the director of the CIA. And the Korean War didn't begin until June 1950. So there's been a widespread disinformation strategy, which is, we only got into this because it was defensive, because we were reacting to what the communist Chinese were doing to the captured American pilots during the Korean War. So that's total disinformation, because it was already in place before the beginning of the Korean War.
But at any hence rate, that label, Manchurian Candidate, because that was the area they were traveling through, was in Manchuria, right?
Well, there's the book in the 50s and then the movie starring Frank Sinatra called The Manchurian Candidate.
Sure.
And the basic plot for the movie is described in so the two original mind control programs were Bluebird and Artichoke. So in the Bluebird Artichoke documents, I've got a memo from one CIA officer to another CIA officer several years before the book was published. And the one officer is expressing concern that a group of GIs were captured while passing through a zone in Manchuria, were subjected to some sort of mind control, and have amnesia for their period of interrogation. So the CIA was already describing the basic plot line of the movie and the book years before it came out. And that is the plot line. So these GIs are captured, they're subjected to all this mind control, and one of them becomes a programmed assassin trying to take out a politician. And there's a his handler is his mother, and there's a hypnotic code that's programmed in, which is a specific playing card. All of that kind of stuff is completely, clearly, explicitly described in detail in the Bluebird, Artichoke, MKUltra documents. So that stuff is not fiction. It was done going back to the Second World War. It was operational, and it included using a whole variety of techniques to create these new identities, insert a hypnotic access code, and use them for a variety of types of missions, including document retrieval, courier assignments, penetration, infiltration, and combat type assignments. All of that completely documented objective fact. So that's kind of the beginning of those programs. And then I got this 15,000 pages of documents. And in parallel, I went to the medical school library, which is a lot of work because there's nothing electronic going back in the 50s. You have to pull volume 1, volume 2, volume 3 off the shelf, open it up, look through it, take it to the photocopy machine, take it back, put it on the shelf, do the next. So that's 1950, then 1951, then 1952. Then you do that for the next journal and the next journal and the next journal. So that took me quite a while in my spare time. But I have a whole filing cabinet full of all these papers published in the 50s, 60s, a few in the early 70s. And by cross-linking all these documents, I'm able to show that this person received this amount of money in this year through MKUltra. This is the sub-project number, top secret clearance level. Here's the subject matter of the research. Here's the front organization that the money was funneled through. And here's the published paper in which the funding by the front organization is acknowledged. So there's this whole network of all of this information that none of it is somebody told me that or I suspect that. It's all completely documented. And in that whole network, the CIA created several front organizations, the Human Ecology Foundation, the Josiah Macy Jr. Foundation, the Geschichter Fund, all of which were active in MKUltra and related programs. And then when you're looking at the actual papers, it'll have the title of the paper, the authors, page 1, and down at the bottom, there'll be an acknowledgement of funding sources. And it'll either say funded by the U.S. Office of Naval Research, the Air Force Office of Scientific Research, the Department of the Army, one of the front organizations, Human Ecology, Geschichter, or the U.S. Public Health Service, or in quite a bit of the research, the Scottish Rite Foundation. So that's how I was able to tie it in. And so the Scottish Rite Foundation, which is obviously the Masons, was co-funding LSD research and mind control research with the CIA. And the people receiving the money were cleared at top secret by the CIA in the 50s and 60s. Absolute fact, can't be debated. So let me just kind of give you some examples. This is from page 144 of my CIA doctor's book. So in a 1958 paper, Dr. William Malamud was identified as the medical research director and Dr. Winfred Overholser as the chairman of the Scottish Rite Research Committee. Another 1958 paper states that the second author, Dr. Sidney Workman, received his MD from Cornell in 1952, where he worked under Dr. Harold Wolff, MKUltra contractor, and director of the CIA cutout, the Human Ecology Foundation. Now, Dr. Overholser worked with Dr. Joel Elkies when Dr. Elkies was director of research at St. Elizabeth's Hospital, and prior to Dr. Elkies becoming chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at Johns Hopkins. So we've got Scottish Rite, MKUltra, Cornell, Human Ecology, St. Elizabeth's Hospital, and Johns Hopkins all tied together. And this guy, Winfred Overholser, gave his presidential address to the American Psychiatric Association in Washington in May 1948. And in a biographical sketch, he's described as having been born in Worcester, Massachusetts, received his MD in 1916, is described in his own writing as using hypnosis and suggestion in World War I. Then he became superintendent of St. Elizabeth's Hospital, where over 5,000 naval officers and enlisted men were treated as patients. And he's described in his biographical sketch as a 32nd degree Mason. His son, Winfred Overholser Jr., was born in 1930, went to New York Medical College, and worked, did his residency at New York State Psychiatric Institute from 1956 to 1959. In 1953 at New York State Psychiatric Institute, a tennis pro named Harold Blauer was killed with a dose of U.S. Army mescaline by Dr. Paul Hawk. So you see this like network of all these connections. Then Dr. Overholser was born in Worcester, Massachusetts. Hudson Hoagland of the Worcester Foundation for Experimental Biology was a contractor on MKUltra Subproject 8. He wrote an obituary for Dr. Ewan Cameron, who is a subcontractor on MKUltra Subproject 68. Hudson Hoagland was recommended to J. Edgar Hoover by George Estabrooks, a 32nd degree Mason, who received, and he received money from for LSD research from the Scottish Rite Committee. MKUltra and MKSearch top secret cleared contractor Dr. Carl Pfeiffer also received money from the Scottish Research Foundation. A co-author of Dr. Hoagland's, Dr. Robert Hyde, received top secret clearance for LSD research under MKUltra. Another co-author of Dr. Hoagland's, Dr. Malamud, did lobotomy research at Worcester State Hospital. And it just goes on and on and on and on and on like that. But I know it's kind of mind-boggling to keep track of. But basically, there's this huge network of doctors, institutions, documented top secret clearance under MKUltra, and funding by the Scottish Rite Foundation, and membership at the 32nd degree in the Masons.
Dr. Ross, why, in your opinion, would the Scottish Rite fund these programs or the Scottish Rite organizations?
Well, in my opinion, I don't know for sure. But I imagine there's more than one answer. So one is, first of all, I don't think that like 99% of Masons have the faintest idea about any of this. But sure. these top level guys clearly did. And basically, I think it's all an old boys network, an old boys club. So these guys belong to certain like social clubs in New York City. They belong to the Masons. They either participated in World War II or they're connected into the intelligence network. They're connected into academia. And so these are just guys who know each other and run in the same circles. And so when they want to talk somebody into providing money for research, well, they'll go talk to their high-level friends in the Masons, or they'll go talk to their high-level friends in the CIA, or they'll lean on their friends in government. So I don't know if it's really the organization as such. I think it's more the individuals using their connections and their funding sources in kind of an entrepreneurial, you know, street hustle kind of fashion to get money. Mm-hmm. So that's one part of it. The other part, though, is now we're outside documents, just the things I've heard from patients that I can't prove at all. I certainly have heard from not one or two, but not hundreds of patients who describe very organized ritual abuse and mind control, not in satanic cults, but in Masonic lodges. So it may be that just as in the Catholic Church, you can find this, you know, small, not that small actually in the Catholic Church, but, you know, deviant subculture of priests who are all abusing people all over the place, and then you have the institutional cover up or denial or looking the other way. Think in the Masons, there could very, or in the military or in the Boy Scouts or, you know, the soccer coach or whoever, you can have pedophiles who are basically predators who are operating in those circles because they can get access to victims, because it's either children, it's mentally ill, it's members of the church, it's choir boys. And some of these groups are more organized and using more mind control than just the average perpetrator. And I think that would be true in the Masons. And so those guys would be interested in mind control, and then they would get their buddies to fund, and on it goes.
I've come across a lot of, I guess you could call them exposés about this kind of scientific experimentation and or ritual abuse or both, just with children, you know. And I just have never quite understood why, other than the fact that they can't really defend themselves because they haven't developed all of the skills, whether they be physical or mental, why kids seem to be targeted. And I mean, I'm sure that not all parents are giving informed consent over some of these things. I mean, I read something about a man who was an epileptic, and they were doing experiments with implanting things within his brain back in the 70s. And it just, to me as a parent, it just seems like mind-boggling that we're treating our children, that people would treat children like this.
And you'd think all this stuff would be very hidden.
Yeah.
But on a brain electrode subject, so brain electrodes research was funded under MKUltra. It was also funded by various branches of the military. And military CIA-funded brain electrode implant work was done at UCLA, Tulane, Harvard, and Yale, for sure. And that's just, you know, what I know about. So at Yale, there was a neurosurgeon named Jose Delgado, who was funded by the U.S. Office of Naval Research. And he was cross-funded with the group at Harvard, and they in turn communicated with the UCLA and Tulane people. So Jose Delgado at Yale, you can look him up on YouTube, Dr. Jose Delgado bull ring video. And you'll see him standing in a bull ring with a little transmitter in his hand. There's an electrode implanted in the bull's brain, and this transmitter box, when he pushes a button, sends a signal to the bull's brain. So the bull would otherwise charge at him, but when he pushes the button, the bull turns in the other direction. And so that's easily available on YouTube. If you go to the medical school library and look them up, you'll find what I found, which is all these papers that acknowledge funding by the military. And he describes putting electrodes in cats, monkeys, etc. And he refers to them as mechanical toys. But he also describes putting brain electrodes in an 11-year-old boy, 16-year-old girl. And there's photographs of these people in his book and in his papers. So you see the 16-year-old girl with bandage on her head, because originally you had to have a port in the person's skull, and then the wire is actually connected directly to the person. So Jose Delgado made the next step, which is a remote transmitter box that activates the electrode, and you can close the skull over. But so there's a 16-year-old girl with bandages on her head, and she's either staring off into space with a blank grin on her face, strumming her guitar, or pounding furiously on the wall, depending on which electrode is being stimulated by which button he's pushing on the transmitter box. And the 11-year-old boy, he said when he pushed a certain button to activate a certain electrode, the boy started to say he thought really he was a girl and he wanted to marry Dr. Delgado.
Wow. So interesting.
This is the declassified tip of the iceberg. You know, this is what went on in public that they admit to.
Yeah, well, that's what they're willing to admit to, right? Crazy. That is just crazy. And, you know, it's like something out of THX 1138. There's a part in that old movie where the guy, where they're pushing buttons, and they're like, watch this, when we do this, what he does. And there's Robert Duvall going into convulsions and throwing his arms out or whatever based on whatever button and tonal vibrations coming through the emitter.
Right.
It's crazy. Crazy.
Yeah, I like that movie.
Yeah, I have a copy of it.
there's brain electrode implants in the Denzel Washington remake of The Manchurian Candidate as well.
Right.
Yeah, I think I remember that.
Yeah, I do. I remember seeing that as well.
Any gay people who are listening are going to like the next story. So Robert Heath was a psychiatrist at Tulane, and there's a Robert Heath Society website that's still active. He's a much revered, respected guy who's dead now. But in the early 70s, he published a paper in the Journal of Nervous and Mental Disease, and he was funded by various branches of the military and the CIA. And a lot of the times he would put brain electrodes in and then literally pour LSD or mescaline right into somebody's brain and then measure their EEG to see how it was affecting their brain. But in this paper, he's curing the mental disease of homosexuality, which was officially classified as automatically a mental disorder by the American Psychiatric Association in the early 70s. And so what he does is he puts an electrode in the guy's brain, a series of electrodes, hooks him up to an EEG, and then he stimulates certain electrodes. So one of the wires is going into a pleasure center in the guy's brain, and when it's stimulated by the transmitter, it brings him up to a pre-orgasmic state. And so they had him in a pre-orgasmic state, and they had him watch heterosexual pornography to recondition him into being straight. And then they thought, well, we'll just put the transmitter box on his belt, on a little clip-on the belt, so he can push the button anytime he wants. But they had to take it away from him because he pushed it 1,500 times in 3 hours.
Whoa.
Then at the end of the paper, they describe, okay, they've got him reconditioned. They think they've cured this disease of homosexuality. Now they, this is all paid for by the taxpayer, bring a prostitute in, who they pay, have him and the prostitute go into a room and have sex while they're monitoring his brainwaves remotely. And then afterwards, they debrief the prostitute and the guy, and she says, yeah, he had a normal orgasm and seemed to enjoy it. Everything was fine. And the guy says, yeah, I enjoyed it. And then he was followed up for nine months with only one relapse. Relapse equals into homosexuality. So you would think, no, that's so stupid. Somebody just made that up. But again, that's what's in the medical literature.
I wonder what happened with that guy 10 years down the road.
And probably pretty messed up and probably still gay, I would think.
Definitely a little bit conflicted, I think, at that point, right?
Yeah.
And, wow, that's amazing. I mean, this is, like you said, all taxpayer-funded research and government-funded research through the, you know, various other organizations and foundations that may fund it as well. They're getting tax write-offs, right, a lot of these organizations
There was the Geschichter Foundation was one of the front organizations, and what the CIA did with some research on terminal cancer patients at Georgetown University is they didn't describe in detail what they were doing to those people, but it was mind control. And they created an annex at Georgetown University Hospital, and they put two biochemists in there undercover to do some sort of hallucinogen or drug experiments on terminal cancer patients. And because the CIA gave the money to the Geschichter Foundation, which was a private foundation, which then funded the research, that triggered matching funds from another sector of the federal government. So they got like twice the dollars. So you can't accuse them of being dumb.
Right. I'm curious. You said, and I've heard this before, that homosexuality had previously been recognized as a mental disorder, and I don't necessarily perceive it as such, and I've never really had an issue with it either way, but I have noticed that over the past few decades we've had a movement to like recognize and accept homosexuality as being just a natural occurrence in a person and a sexual orientation. And as legitimate as I think that that is, absolutely, I wonder if, you know, this is as a conspiracy theory subject, do you think that that could have been like a precursor to the movement to like reclassify pedophilia as a sexual orientation that I've heard of happening somewhere in Europe?
Well, I have an article under review at a journal. It's gone already through one round of revisions, so I'm hoping they accept the latest round of revisions and then it's officially impressed and then it'll be published, basically discussing all of this. So
I'm not trying to compare homosexuality with pedophilia at all. By any means, I just want to state that for the record.
Okay.
I don't have a problem with homosexuals, but I have a major problem with pedophiles.
Right,
so I just want to make that clear to any of the listeners. I don't want to offend anybody. I was just...
Right. And same here. And, you know, this is such an explosive topic, you always have to be careful to not give the wrong impression. So just personally, I totally agree with you. Homosexuality has nothing to do with mental health. It's not a disease or a disorder or anything like that. So but in this article, what I do is I review the history of it, which there's these diagnostic manuals, first edition, second edition, third edition, fourth. So the first edition came out in 1952. The second one in 68, third was 1980, fourth was 1994, and DSM-5 just came out in 2013. These are basically the manual for making psychiatric diagnoses published by the American Psychiatric Association. So in DSM-2, homosexuality was automatically a mental disorder. And that was the end of discussion. So then there's a bunch of political turmoil and a gay lobby, and they kind of soften it in DSM-3. And now it was called, so the disorder in DSM-2 was just called homosexuality. That was the name of the mental disorder.
Still a disorder, though.
In DSM-3, it became ego dystonic homosexuality. which means, and it specifically said, being gay in and of itself is not a mental disorder. The mental disorder is having conflict or unhappiness about it. And then, so that was, you know, they kind of caved in a little, but it was still in there. And there was no heterosexual ego dystonic disorder.
Right, I was going to ask if there was that.
Then in 1994, so there's more lobbying. So then in 1994 edition, they got rid of ego dystonic homosexuality. Now it's buried in psychosexual disorder not otherwise specified. One of the subtypes is people have a conflict about their sexual orientation or unhappiness about it. So they kind of tried to, you know, get under the radar, but still keep it in there. And then in 2013, it's just totally out. So in parallel with that, we have gender identity disorder. But there's a time lag of a decade or two. And now we have the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, you know, community and lobby group. And basically their position is these things aren't mental disorders. It's just the way people are. Stop, you know, bothering us about it sort of thing. And we should have the same rights as everybody else.
Yeah.
So that includes gender identity disorder. So in the DSM-4, gender identity disorder was automatically a mental disorder just by itself. Didn't have to be upset, didn't have to have conflict. You were just automatically mentally ill if you had gender identity disorder. Now in DSM-5 that comes out in 2013, it's been renamed gender dysphoria. So, and it says you're not automatically mentally ill just because you're transgendered. The mental illness is having the conflict or dysphoria, which means unhappiness. So that's the same shift as we did with homosexuality a couple decades earlier. It's no longer automatically a mental disorder. It's only if you have conflict about it. But still,
what
we don't.
What about pedophilia, though?
Well,
where does that fall into all of that?
So I'll get to that in a second. But the problem now is there's an inconsistency and a contradiction and a big political issue, because the transgender people are lobbying not to be stigmatized, not to be mentally ill. But if you're going to follow that path, then in DSM 6 or 7, it should be totally out of the manual and has nothing to do with mental health at all, if it follows the same track as homosexuality. But then the problem becomes, if it's not a mental disorder and psychiatrists don't diagnose it, then insurance companies are not going to pay for gender reassignment.
Wow.
So that's the bind. Which way do you want it to be here? It's a disorder that needs to be fixed, or it's not a disorder because we don't want the stigma. And trying to have it both ways where it's going to be tricky, because if it's not a disorder, then why should it be paid for by insurance companies? Why shouldn't it just be like breast implants? You happen to want bigger breasts? Feel free, go for it. It's not a mental disorder, but insurance is not going to pay for it. So
right.
That's a whole social issue, you know, that's everybody's trying to tap dance around and not really mention and talk about right now. But
no, those insurance companies, they're just so awesome.
But no, it's really like it's a law of unintended conditions and consequences that occur in this, quagmire of logistics, really, is what it comes down to.
So now in parallel with that, it's kind of nebulous concerning being a pedophile. So being a pedophile, being gay, being transgendered, being a transvestite, up until DSM-4, we're all in the same section called psychosexual disorders, and they were all mental disorders. Okay, so then we drop homosexuality out. We're sort of in the process of dropping gender identity disorder out. And we've now split this section into three. So we've got sexual dysfunction section, which is like trouble getting an erection, no sexual desire, inhibited arousal in a woman, etc. So it's kind of like behavioral problems, for which the treatment's mostly behavioral. And by definition, there's not a medical cause for those things. Then we've got another section, which is gender dysphoria, which is the only diagnosis in that section. Then we got a whole another section, which is the paraphilias, paraphilic disorders. And they're defined as behaviors that don't have the goal of foreplay, penetration between two biologically normal consenting adults. that's a paraphilia. But to become a disorder, there has to be either a non-consenting victim or some sort of conflict or unhappiness about it. But now we've got lumped into this category. We've got like cross-dressing, which has no victim, no non-consenting partner. People can feel fine about it and can make a living from it. So why is that in there with indecent exposure, frotcherism, which is a weird thing, but that's where you kind of hump on people in the subway.
So, sorry.
Or childhood sexual abuse, which are clearly crimes, clearly have non-consenting victims. So if they're crimes and they have non-consenting victims, why are they mental disorders? Why don't we have bank robbery disorder?
Right.
It's also like murky and contradictory. And so there's a diagnosis called sexual sadism, and then there's the diagnosis called sexual masochism. So it specifies that sexual sadism, there has to be a non-consenting victim. But in sexual masochism, it doesn't specify that the person has to fail to give consent. And in fact, you can have two consenting adults who just like to have some kinky sex, and there's no non-consenting victim. Mm-hmm. So again, that's kind of murky. But then we get over to pedophilia, and it doesn't say that there has to be a non-consenting victim. So why does there have to be a non-consenting victim for sadism but not for pedophilia?
Right.
And so you could kind of mount an argument that pedophilia is being sort of softened and on the way out the way homosexuality was. Or you could just say this whole book is full of inconsistencies and contradictions. Or you could say, no, childhood sexual abuse is clearly in there as a mental disorder. But that takes you back to, out of all the different criminal behaviors that go on, why isn't robbing a bank, selling swampland to unsuspecting suckers, selling aluminum siding to retired people, why aren't those things mental disorders? Well, what's the purpose of having pedophilia as a mental disorder just anyway? And then that takes you to, okay, if we take it out of the DSM, does that mean we are going to decriminalize it? Or does it mean we're just going to say it's criminal behavior, nothing to do with mental health? So the whole thing is like just so murky and contradictory and unclear.
But yet the legal system operates using this as a guide. This is definitely applied to the process of any sort of justice or any sort of legality that's dispositioned. This is the guide that's used.
Right. But there's a little statement at the beginning that says, this is just a clinical guide. It shouldn't be used for forensic decisions. But everybody basically ignores that.
But we treat people for the mental disorder of having gone through or the mental effect of having gone through child abuse or sexual abuse as children. So I'm just curious. I don't know why it seems that, like, as you said, it seems as though even pedophilia is being a little softened and it's not really looked at as, like, there's obviously something causing mental problems in the people who were the victims. So where's the mental issue in the person causing that?
Well, in the DSM-5, it now says they have some sort of unhappiness or conflict about it. That's the mental disorder. But that's inching towards, it's not inherently a mental disorder. So if you have sex with non-consenting children, which automatically equals all children, and you feel fine about it, then it's, why is it a mental disorder?
And how is feeling fine about that not a mental disorder?
Exactly, yeah.
So let's shift gears a little bit, and this is going right into this. It's a segue as far as what I would like to discuss with you next, Dr. Ross, and that is, you've made mention of your moral stance with regards to some of the things you've already just described here in this conversation with us, the different electrode experiments, the different just behavioral experiments that were performed on oftentimes minors or unwitting participants or unwitting subjects, and you've discussed the moral implications to this. And, you know, right now in our current climate, we have the embedded psychiatrists and psychologists during enhanced interrogation horrors that we're hearing from all over the world. And I wonder if you might elaborate on the stance with regards to your position for the listening audience, because I think it's a really relevant and important discussion to have with regards to where psychiatry is today.
Sure. So this stuff is not science fiction and it's not ancient history. It's documented fact and it's ongoing. And what do I mean by this stuff? Well, what I mean by this stuff is you can easily Google Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay. And up come all kinds of pictures, images. You know, the Senate has debated whether waterboarding is or is not torture, but nobody debates whether the CIA and the military have been waterboarding lots of people. So these things are definitely going on. And in the Abu Ghraib pictures, you see a whole variety of classical mind control techniques going on. First of all, the person's imprisoned, so they got sensory deprivation, sleep deprivation, food deprivation. Then they're shocked electrically. They're hooded. They're made to stand in forced positions for prolonged periods. It's very painful. They're humiliated sexually by being disrobed and being mocked by female military members. They're forced to masturbate while being observed by female military members. There's various kinds of drugs that we don't have that much information about the types of drugs that are used. So these are classical, these are called enhanced interrogations today. Enhanced interrogation is just a slightly sanitized term for brainwashing mind control. It's all the same stuff. So all of the current enhanced interrogations equal mind control brainwashing programs that have been ongoing since the 50s. And at Guantanamo Bay, we know that there's behavioral science consultation teams, which is psychiatrists and psychologists, actively there and participating. That's a documented fact, not disputed. And actually, one of the people who was killed by Colonel Hassan at Fort Hood had previously been stationed at Guantanamo Bay, which makes me wonder whether that guy was a random target or not. But at any rate, these things are massive violations of medical ethics and basic human decency. They violate the Geneva Convention. They violate all ethical codes going back to ancient Rome. These people do not give informed consent. They don't give any kind of consent. It's not for medical treatment. It's harmful. And not uncommonly, these guys who get interrogated die. So it completely violates all the principles of medicine. It's completely unethical. And if anybody did that on U.S. soil, it would be medical malpractice and they would be sued easily and successfully. And they'd lose their licenses. I mean, these are just the facts of the situation. So one guy who, I don't remember all the exact details, but there's a guy at Guantanamo Bay named Omar Khadr, K-H-A-D-R, I think is how it's spelled. And he's been there for some period of time. And I'm not remembering the years exactly right, but roughly speaking, somewhere around 2002, 2005, he was captured during a firefight in Afghanistan and was taken to Guantanamo Bay, where he's been subjected to enhanced interrogations for many years. He was actually a Canadian citizen, but he was back there visiting relatives. And so the Canadian government's been involved, and there's been discussion about whether he's going to be shifted from Guantanamo to Canada, with a lot of resistance by the military. And during this firefight, some U.S. soldiers died, and one lost his eye. And there's very impassioned testimony from family members of those people identifying this Omar Khadr as a war criminal, a terrorist, and a combatant. And so because he's a terrorist, a war criminal, and a combatant, that's why he's at Guantanamo Bay. Plus, there's an allegation, but no documentation, that his father may have had some interaction with Osama bin Laden. So it's not proven, not known. So this enemy combatant, now we're protecting freedom and democracy, right? So this enemy combatant,
yeah.
Enemy combatant is brought to the United States of America because Guantanamo Bay is U.S. soil, even though it's in Cuba. And he's subjected to all of this enhanced interrogation, which is basically torture. How old was he when this firefight took place, and what kind of participation did he have in the firefight? So it's a huge firefight with all this chaos, and it's very, when you read the military documents, they contradict each other. It's very hazy and fuzzy. He may or may not have thrown a grenade. He may or may not have fired any shots, but the photographs of him show him, you know, half buried under rubble, severely injured, being attended to by U.S. medics before he's evacuated. And what happened was, the way the firefight started was, the American forces came to the village and engaged the village in combat. So they weren't like just walking on patrol and somebody attacked them. They went at the village. Admitted to, not disputed by the army. Okay, so the remaining detail is, exactly how old was this military combatant terrorist when this firefight took place? 12 years old.
Wow.
So this is a case of documented, systematic, prolonged abuse of a child on U.S. soil by the government of the United States. If any civilian did that in the continental United States, they would be charged with a crime, convicted, and imprisoned. But the taxpayer is funding this. This is systematic, organized child abuse by the government, and psychiatrists and psychologists are participating in this. And we're justifying it by calling this kid a terrorist and military combatant.
That concludes part one of our discussion with Dr. Colin Ross on the CIA, mind control, and psychiatry. Please download part two for the continuation of our discussion, and thank you so much for joining us here in the Middle Chamber.